Oh, it's such an honor, Danny, to be a part of this amazing podcast you're doing here. And it's just really cool to be talking about this book.
You know my work and you've given it a lot of thought, and I don't normally get such good questions, to be honest.
That was so fun.
Yeah, it sure was, especially the quiz. Thanks for preparing that for me.
Thank you for your wonderful questions.
Best with these things, just turn into a conversation.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, you obviously got the book.
Good on you for fighting the good fight too.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
I love your enthusiasm. I just think it's a brilliant thing you're doing, a podcast about, you know, books, and you do a lot of great interviews, so I'm really honoured to be part of it.
I so enjoy listening to the podcast. I love it.
You're listening to Words and Nerds Podcast with Danny V. What an absolute pleasure to welcome Trent Dalton to the podcast for the second time. Author and journalist Trent Dalton is author of Boy Swallows Universe, one of the best-selling books of 2018 and a firm favourite of mine. We chat in depth about Boy Swallows Universe in episode 47, which is also the most listened to episode for 2018. Today, however, we chat about Trent's latest offering by Sea and Stars, The Story of the First Fleet, as well as going off on many other tangents, which has become our preferred style of interview. It's always such a pleasure to speak to Trent, a great bloke, passionate about his family and literature and everything in between. I hope you get as much joy from this interview as I did. I'm your host, Danny V. Welcome back, Trent. I can't tell you how lovely it is to speak to you again. We recorded our first episode about 4 months ago, I think, and talked about Boy Swallows Universe for ages, and listeners love that episode, so no pressure today.
Oh, Danny, it's so great to be back. And, you know, you really set something in train, I think, really early on with that book. And you're one of the first people I had a really good long chat with. And so it's a real pleasure to be back. And you set something in motion on that Boy Swallows Universe book, you know, a whole bunch of people that were there early and you were one of them. And you really, your enthusiasm for it, you throw this thing out into the world and you don't know what it's going to be. And then you speak to people like you who really embrace it, and then it sort of makes you feel a lot more comfortable with it, if that makes sense. So, yeah, so it's really great to be back talking to
awesome,
you.
Awesome, awesome. So today we're going to talk about By Sea and Stars. Now, last time we went off on so many tangents, I have no idea where we're going to go today, but we should start with By Sea and Stars, right?
Yeah, great. Let's start there. Let's start there. In, 1787 to 1788, and see if we can make it back to 2018.
I hope listeners have a really long drive ahead of them.
Yeah, that's a lot of ground to cover, isn't it?
Now, this started as a serial for The Australian. How did it become a novel?
Great question. The real genesis of it was, I'm just fascinated by the guy and his the guy's brain, and that's James Cook. Mm-hmm. So I wrote a previous kind of newspaper serial on that great voyage of discovery of 1770. So, 18 years before The Adventures of Philip and Co. And I really enjoyed it. I really just dived in. I found myself really loving that world for some reason. And the idea of it was, and it was teed up by Paul Whitaker, the former editor-in-chief of The Australian, which is sort of my, my day job. It's I'm a journo on The Australian, and I got to spend about a month diving into that world of Cook, and we turned that into this kind of six-part series that we rolled out each day. And the idea of that series was, let's keep it almost, it had peaks and valleys, and so you like an old-fashioned, it was my moment to be a bit of a Henry Lawson, and this sort of kind of that they used to do it all the time, this newspaper serial, which is this great tradition, Australian tradition of, bringing readers back each day or each week. And that really excited me. What if I could write the story of Cook in a way that, left people wanting more each day? And that was a real, really successful kind of thing. And it really got people, sort of whet people's appetites for a bit more of this stuff. And then Paul Whitaker came back to me, he sort of said, look, we'd love something over the summer of, it was basically the turn of, 2017 to 2018, and we'll give readers something over that summer. And he suggested Pioneers, so Australian Pioneers, like that pioneer sort of history. And I'm really interested in that, obviously. But I said, look, I'd love to do that, and I will do that when I get a chance. But can I just do one thing first? And before that, the story of the First Fleet, which I've always been fascinated in, I threw that out at him. Look, the next step from Cook was, look, he goes back, he's got this amazing diary, and he says to the British government, you know, there's a pretty amazing place down there. I've seen it with my own eyes. Yeah, 17 years later, they're looking for a place to send these prisoners. And Joseph Banks, which is the wonderful thing about these history stories, is that the characters always come back. He says to the British Parliament, look, you should send them all to this place we've seen called Botany Bay. And that's an amazing moment in history to me, Danny. That is like this crazy idea that they had, this sort of social experiment. Mm. And we'll send them over there. And I just thought that could make a pretty interesting serial. Sorry, you've only asked me one question.
It's fine. Okay. Wait, you know, we're starting with 1788. Listeners know they're in for the long haul.
Okay, good. So then you know, this thing runs, and it was sort of this wonderful bloke got to be a bit of a co-conspirator named Eric Lebecki, who's this genius artist who I love his cartoons on the Oz, right? And I said, but Eric Lebecki is actually this wonderful painter who does these other pieces outside of his kind of daily cartoons for the Australian. And so I said to him, Eric, look, I want to actually turn this thing on the First Fleet into a graphic novel. So this thing was actually originally a kind of a graphic novel that I had planned. Yeah, the book that you have in your hands now, which has become this beautiful little hardback kind of wonderful little stocking filler, it actually had its origins in my head as a graphic novel.
Wow.
And I pitched to Eric. I said, mate, could you illustrate this? Not with your usual kind of works that you do for the paper, but with those amazing, I've seen his artworks that he does on his spare time. And these are these really dark, kind of interesting pieces that are cartoon-based, but speak to my actual, I have a love of actual comic books, right? Like comic books. So even, you know, I should have written about it with Eli Bell in Boy Swallows Universe, that, you know, a lot of my time in, you know, Housing Commission, Bracken Ridge and stuff, I was reading a lot of comic books to sort of take me away from some of that sort of more kind of nightmarish stuff sometimes, and kind of stepping into the world and, you know, characters and all these kind of stories. And I've always loved it ever since, you know, and that has bled into that love of comics, then bled into my love of graphic novels. There's a guy I really admire from my hometown, Brisbane. He's a Scottish guy, Eddie Campbell, who he did the artwork for that like groundbreaking graphic novel From Hell. And so from there, I learned a lot about the works of Alan Moore and so forth. And I thought, let's do the Alan Moore treatment on the First Fleet. And that's still, you know, look, you know, you can still do an amazing graphic novel on that. Yeah. But Eric just did the most amazing art pieces that we ran as a serial to it. Like, they accompanied my serialized kind of version of this story. Now, the great Catherine Milne, who edited Boy Swallows Universe, just as we were going through the edits and sort of really early days on Boy Swallows Universe, this story ran. She didn't even know I was doing this thing. And it sort of got a bit of traction, these serialized pieces on the First Fleet. And she said, you know what, Trent, I think we could do something with this. And I was like, oh. And we were still like, Boy Swallows Universe was, you know, sort of about to hit. And, you know, I didn't know what that was going to be. And I was just over the moon that she might even want to turn this into a book. And she's amazing, that woman, because she sort of saw it as what it became. And the thing that you hold there, Danny, is kind of this beautiful. She saw it. She has a way of seeing things that is really beautiful. And I think you have to be so immersed in the publishing industry to know, to have the vision for this stuff. She saw what it could be, this beautiful little hardback, and then it could be just this little, you know, something, we could turn it into something that almost belongs on those boats, you know what I mean? It's from those ye olde times.
Yeah.
It's got this whimsical kind of nature to it, the thing. And then, you know, the HarperCollins design team, I tell you, they come on board, and then they turn it into sort of, they go, look, I'll give this marbling effect on the cover, and then I'll give it this gold kind of lettering on it, and it turns it into just something beautiful. Actually, you know, I won't bore you, but I have the love of books as you do, you know, and I've seen all the books, you know, the way you treat books and stuff. I love that, Danny, the way you sort of treat them, you know, you cherish them. And I love that too. And I love that's what those guys who created this thing, that's what they sort of do. And that's how they see kind of publishing as well. And I thought that'd be wonderful that you'd sort of make a part of that. And yeah, and next thing you know, whilst Boy Swallows Universe was kind of on its own little rollicking ride, this other beautiful little thing was happening, and it was sort of just so it's just been a nuts year, Danny. It's just been really crazy. It's just been wild, yeah. So it's really great to be talking to you about this one.
Yeah, and it is a beautiful book. It's a beautiful book to hold. And like you said, the old kind of feeling with the pages feel really nice. I'm one of those people who feel pages and smell pages.
Yeah, yeah, it's really nice. Funny. It's so, no, so do I. And that was one of the things, like, I literally, like, the one thing I love is just, like, you know, forget the content, just the sort of the end pages, you know. They did these, the end pages, you know, for all your listeners, there's just this beautiful sort of celestial scene, and it's kind of, they're drawing on those wonderful maps that these guys used, and the astronomy and all that, that is such a part of these journeys back then, you know. And I thought, that's what they've got. And then they, the marbling effect, they just blew my mind, because it's actually like a marbled sort of thing that the designer found, but it does absolutely reflect on, you know, on top of the sea and the stars on the bottom. Is quite an amazing thing. I said, sent back to the, when they sent me a potential cover, I just said, oh, that's goes far and away beyond anything I could have imagined for it. It's just amazing the way these people's brains work. You know, it's like, I just work in black words, right? Like on white, you know, that's all I do, you know, and I try and see things in my head, but these guys work in colors and kind of textures. And it's sort of really cool to sort of, when those teams meet up and they turn something into sort of something so much bigger, it's a sum of all of its parts. Hey, it's like, it's sort of like, wow, it's just a pretty cool, hopefully cool kind of rollicking little insight into how they got from there to here. And but I think packaged together, it just steps it up a little bit, you know, so that's really cool.
I love that journey from your graphic novel idea to what it has become. I think that's awesome. And I really want to know about your research. I mean, I read a little bit about you being in the Mitchell and Dixon Library at the New South Wales State Library and using these 11 known journal manuscripts in existence. I mean, 9 are held at the State Library. What was it like using these original manuscripts? It must have been amazing.
Oh, Danny, I mean, that was my X-Files moment. That was like the woman at the library, you know, she just, Elise, she puts on the gloves, she gets her swipe card, her special sort of national, her state library sort of swipe card, and takes me up to the unknown floors. And, you know, we go into these sort of corridors and into these rooms, and then she swipes a card again, and then a door opens, and I walk into this room and lay down on this large oval-shaped table. The 9 diaries, the diaries that were written by the men that were on these ships, you know, sadly, you know, none written by the women, but we're talking the actual things that were on those ships, and they're sitting there on that table. Also, the first kind of printed kind of version of Arthur Phillips' diarised account, you know, so it's like his massively and lengthy title, which I won't bore people with, but it goes on forever, that title. It's all about his expedition. And also accompanying that are artworks, letters home, like the actual letters, Danny. It was
crazy,
just like, it was,
right?
it put a chill down my spine. Oh. I mean, in that, if you had a DNA sample that were tested, you know, you would probably get traces of the slop they were eating for dinner. You know, you would get sense of the salt water that was splashing onto the pages. Like, it's that connected to that ship.
Oh,
that's
when
what
I was,
really blew me away. And you just said, you know, you're there thumbing through it.
God, with your gloves on?
Yeah, totally put the gloves on. I mean, you know, and thankfully this is the great blessing, of course. Like, I didn't have to take them back. Like, it was written just like Boyce Fuller's Universe in the rumpus room of my home in Brisbane, that book. So, you know, I wasn't able to take all those diaries home. And thankfully, Elise just hooked me up with the whole digitized version, in which, brilliantly, you can actually, you know, you can do the control F and find words and keywords and cut all through, and so you can bounce back and forth between those diaries, which is really handy from a journalistic point of view, because it's so overwhelming. You go, where do I read that thing about that bit, and where does that guy come back in again? You can just remember little parts and go, oh, that's right, yeah, Ralph Clark, he mentioned that over here, and that related to something that you know, that officer such and such did on this ship over here, and it's sort of, you could really bounce to and from, and that was really handy. So basically, in the end, I printed them all out, and I had this tower of documents on my little desk in this rumpus room, and all around there was then all these other books on the first fleet. And so it was a wild old sort of deep dive into that world for a while, and came brilliantly just after, you know, really putting the full stops on the edits and stuff on the process of Boyce Fuller's Universe. So you imagine, it was such a welcome relief to sort of step away from this world that of Boyce Fuller's Universe, which is kind of, you know, Housing Commission Brackenridge and crime and like heroin addiction and, you know, jails and prison, you know, like prison escapes and all this sort of heady stuff that is kind of does belong in my heart and in the back of my head. But it was so great just to dive into the salt water of 1788. You know what I mean? It was such a great welcome kind of just, yeah, listen, what a great diversion. And so I really enjoyed it. Yeah, really enjoyed the writing of it. But it all stemmed from that, as you say, that moment in that library. And just these wonderful librarians who just love this stuff. You know, it was then those guys who helped me, they go, oh, you've got to see this guy, Ralph Clark. And I'm like, who's Ralph Clark? And they go, oh, read this.
I did like his story. It shows such a complexity of the contradictions, right, of the human experience. And I love the quote, Australia does totally funny things to a person.
Oh, yes. Yes, it does funny things to a person. That's
yes,
right.
Lieutenant, I mean, Ralph Clark.
He's such a holier than thou kind of person on the voyage over, talking about how he's horrified by these prostitutes and the behaviour of these officers and Marines, and all the booze they drink, and what does he do when he gets when he gets to Australia? The first thing is basically cheats on his wife, and Australia does funny things, and it's a long journey, and it's a bloody strange old place, it's a different world, you got to remember that. That's why I was fascinated with that. It's like, if you go to a different world, do you become a different person? And I thought that's a fascinating notion. I wonder how many of those people who came to this land created new selves. And Arthur Phillip plays on that too. He plays on that notion. So you can be one person back in England, which was a criminal. But here, this is a different world. You can create a different you, and I thought that's really interesting. How many families, all of our families, are connected to these people who came out and transformed themselves? And we are born. That is the great thing about our country, not to get all sort of highfalutin, but we started out as this great negative, we started out as, modern Australia, that is, and I won't even go into the 60,000-year history of our incredible Indigenous history, but that's for a whole other book that I hope to write one day. But but that particular time from 1788 onwards started in that kind of great negative. Let's send 750 prisoners over to Australia and we'll see how they get on. Well, we turned that into this amazing positive that we have today, which, we fall and we stumble all the time as a nation, but man, it's a pretty darn good place to live still, right? I bloody love living here, and it's me pretty too. Wondrous, and we've got a pretty interesting multicultural place. And we turned that horrible negative of, these people living in squalor inside prisons and they sure did sort of make a good, go of it. There was bloodshed and there was some horrors along the way, and we're working on those. But I find it really interesting, can you change yourself and can you change the whole nation, It's quite an interesting thought, actually.
And look, I was thinking, if only I'd learnt about the First Fleet in primary school like this, about the individual stories, I think I would have been so much more interested in their stories, because I loved Lieutenant Ralph Clark. I loved the Elizabeths. I really loved Elizabeth Barber. She made me laugh a lot.
Oh, strong character, hey? Strong woman. Like, man, don't cross her.
No way.
But you're so right, Danny. You're so right. I mean, that was sort of partly why I wanted to write it like this. It was sort of, I didn't get it that way. It wasn't taught to me that way. And whereas, I keep saying, I hope, I'm not boring you when I say, it should be as unputdownable to kids as Harry Potter. It's that thrilling, this stuff. It's that wild and crazy and kind of, it's filled with that much story, like it's got betrayal, it's got daring do, it's got adventure, it's got love, it's got brutality and bloodshed and danger, it's like every Aussie kid loves a bit of danger, it's just like, this has so much danger and survival, this wasn't meant to happen. They weren't meant to survive this trip. Like, the whole half of England thought they weren't going to, and they were pretty well certain Arthur Phillip was going to fail. But what if you told that story in a way that you drilled in and zeroed in on about 12 or so characters and told it like it was a HBO drama, and you told it like it was The Sopranos, or you told it like it was Deadwood, or I don't know, you told it like Mad Men, like storytelling, where things peak and characters come back, and you kind of just classic storytelling, because you can over 8 months, this journey that they were on, that's a long time to fill in a lot of story. I never knew about Ralph Clark. I never knew about Ralph Clark's dog.
Me neither.
I never knew about,
I'm so happy I do now.
Exactly. I didn't know that Arthur Phillip was a spy. I didn't know that he married a woman and she asked for a prenup. I didn't know there was a guy named Watkin Tench who was just the most charismatic, handsome bloke. And I didn't know there was, all of those characters, there was love story. I didn't know there were women giving birth on it. I didn't know that one of those women, took off on one of the greatest escapes and sort of were one of the first people to sail up to the Torres Strait. It's like, where were they telling me that in the 80s, just going, Trent, listen to this. You know, totally I would have been raptured.
And so when I read this, I was like, this is where it's at. This is what we need to be teaching kids.
That's really good to hear.
Everyone needs Elizabeth Barber in their life.
That's right. That's right. We all need it. We need a bit of Elizabeth in our life. Original, that's exactly right.
Original rebel she is.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and it's the classic thing. It's sort of like everyone keeps asking me, you know, how old can kids be when they start reading this? Like students, you know, because I'd love students to be reading it. And I said, oh, well, actually, yeah, they might see a couple of C words in there from Elizabeth, but but it's nothing they wouldn't have heard on the schoolyard, I guess. But yeah, you're exactly right, though. Yeah, Elizabeth is wonderful, and all those Elizabeths, you know. And I've got a daughter called Elizabeth, so it was fantastically feisty Elizabeths. I'm like, yeah, there's some. Yeah, Beth, go have a read of these people, and you know, some inspiration of very different kind of Elizabeth to the famous ones from over in England. Yeah.
She comes from a long line of amazing, awesome Elizabeths. How great is that?
That's right.
Now, yeah, with the 12 right. or so characters, I mean, I'm sure you read about more than that, but how did these particular characters end up in the novel, and how did you decide who to omit and who stood out for you?
Yeah, the real start for me was this kid, John Hudson, 11-year-old boy. You could pretty much, what I wanted to do was show the sweep of ages for one thing that was on there. So start there. Okay, who's the youngest? Okay, well, there's this boy named John Hudson. So, you know, a chimney sweep. He's got the one job he can do over in the mother country is a chimney sweep for a boy like him, a skinny boy. He's, he dives down chimneys in the, you know, coldest winters of London and, tries not to get suffocated. He's starving. So, like a lot of kids around that time, breaks into one of the more expensive neighbourhoods, steals a gun, he steals a candelabra. And I'm sorry, it's starting to sound a bit like Cluedo there. But, he gets busted and he gets sent, you know, on this journey to a place. The kid can't read, right? So he doesn't read about anything.
For him.
Oh, isn't it? You know, I mean, yeah, that bit, you know, and this is all documented. This is the beauty about it. The story's there. It's laid out. And there's these transcribed court, court appearances of John Hudson. And the judge says, parents? And the kid's got, got none, you know. And, and the judge is like, what happened? And he just said, dead. They're dead. You know, the kid's just so pragmatic and he's just so tough, you know, because he's had to be. And, he can't read. He gets sent to this great southern land that he has no clue about, you know. And they're those interactions that I'm fascinated in. I mean, what was that kid feeling, you know? Where am I going? Like, what? Where is this place? And, you know, he has to be told by the people, the elders that are around him, you know, that have heard the whispers about where they're going, because none of them can, for one, afford books or let alone read. And, you know, a lot of them didn't know where they were heading. And, so, of course, you imagine the fear and the guts that it takes to do this. And John Hudson, so then John Hudson becomes, for me, you know, he's almost like my Eli Bell. You know, I love that idea of seeing these worlds, these unknown worlds, the way Eli Bell was looking at an unknown world, which is the, you know, criminal underworld of southeast Queensland. I know, as ridiculous as that sounds, comparing those two places, you know, the First Fleet, Hull in the First Fleet and Dara in you know, Western Brisbane. But
it's about human experience, right?
It's human experience, Danny, exactly. And it's going into the unknown and survival. How will you survive and how will you navigate this, especially if you're a kid? So immediately that kid just jumped out at me. I just thought, fantastic. And we know, we have evidence that kid makes it, you know, and that's the beautiful thing. So I already knew, well, there's my happy ending. You know, at least this kid makes it. And there's my full circle. You can come back to that kid, but that kid becomes a teenager on that journey. So, you know, and where does he go? And then you could go to the other side of it and go, okay, who was the oldest? And that was a woman named Dorothy Hanlon, who's 82 years old, right? You know, she's a clothes trader, same story as everyone else, you know, gets in trouble through desperation, you know, over in London. And she makes it. Like, she makes it somehow. She makes it on this incredible journey of 8 months. What a survivor.
Mm.
But tragically, you know, she's struck at some point. We know this. We know that at some point she was struck by what you could only assume is a bout of true sadness and depression. And she takes her own life once she reaches the shores of Australia. And she becomes Australia's first recorded act of suicide. And then this is this sort of, the darkness of this story, and that kind of, yeah, this is when we're starting to document the brutality of this land and what it can do. And, you know, I can't imagine what was going through her head, whether she was missing home, whether the journey was too much, or whether she faced a future that she didn't want to face. And that's a really sort of great sadness to that. And then in between, you know, okay, the people I chose, which people who, like Ralph Clark, had a sense of personality. That's what I really wanted to
throw Ralph. In
there, you know, just, yeah. Oh, you know, that's it. It's just like you wanted to just kind of get beyond the red suit, you know, and just sort of go, okay, what else is it about these people? We see these people's portraits, right? You can see their portraits, but you don't know their personalities, but you can get their personalities from diary entries. And so someone like Ralph Clark, who has a very strong personality, and he becomes this cantankerous, crotchety, sort of fussy bloke, and then you get Rogues, and so then you've got your What Contents, who can speak like a, he just writes like this, it's like he's Oscar Wilde, this guy, you know. He's on there and he can tell his story beautifully, you know. And then Jacob Nagel, who gets on there and he goes and sort of meets a prostitute, and he goes and tries and gets a couple of wines and sneaks his way back onto the boat. So he's a rogue, you know. I saw him as Mel Gibson, you know. And so it's sort of like you just – these guys start to flesh out a bit more. And, you know, not like I write on the piece, you know, this guy looks like Mel Gibson, but that's what I have in my head, because all those descriptions are there. They've all come through. And we have that from history, you know, in the notes. We know their ages. We know that they were handsome, and we know they were large, and we know they were small, and we know they were, we know they were fighters, and we know, you know. So I just hooked into those people who would have a bit of character, like you're saying, like Elizabeth Barber, who just this feisty sort of character. And go, okay, what's her story? Or Mary Bryant. So make sure they've got a bit of an arc, you know. So we know that Mary, she gets on there, right? She says she'll have birth. She'll give birth on that voyage, but she's got this great narrative arc, because later on she'll try and escape the colony, you know. And it's sort of like, this is great. We'll make sure we tap in on them. I really made sure that each person I drilled into, we had a great arc for, you know. William Bradley, you know, the Marine, the officer who, he goes mad. He loses his mind, and it's sort of like that. That's what this voyage, and that's what all this voyaging does. And, you know, that guy will later, William Bradley, you know, who will get a point named after him down in that area. And, you know, but he'll go back to England and he'll lose his mind, and then he'll be in danger of being on the same bloody voyage back out as a prisoner, you know. It's sort of like just these amazing little circumstances all through that voyage. And, that was the stuff I looked into, all those great little – it's the stuff I love in storytelling, Danny, when it's like – you know, the matrix of storytelling where you can hook connections up to everybody. And, you know, that's very exciting. And, of course, this journey, though, you know, that matrix, it connects to every, to you and I today, you know, to every Australian, you know. So that's the cool part of that voyage, is that we're all connected to it.
Yeah, and I loved the way you tell an individual story and then you kind of fast forward to their future and their fate. It was captured their hopes and their struggles and whether they made it or they didn't.
Yeah,
it was really... It was really sad, but then sometimes it was really uplifting. You'd be like, oh, no, I really liked you. Well, oh, great. Glad you survived. Yeah. So it was nice to know their full story.
Oh, that's lovely, Danny. That's really cool. I love that you say that. Yeah, I love that too. It's like okay. Oh, you know, you ever seen that movie? This is such an obscure. This is a tangent. Now I'm starting to really go off. I'm sorry. But there's a great movie called Run, Lola, Run.
Oh, no, I've seen that. Yeah.
Yeah, of course you've seen it. So in that, Lola, as she passes people, she bumps into someone, and the directors do this thing where they lay out just photographs of that person's future, and it's kind of like just goes bang, 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 and it happens in a matter of 5 seconds. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of wonderful because you just see someone briefly, but then you go bang, 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 and you get their whole future story, you know. And I sort of incorporated that a little bit, where it's sort of like, look, I don't have time, unfortunately, to go right back, because this is, you know, as I mentioned, a newspaper serial. It was coming in only sort of like 3,000 word parts each day. So I don't have time to flesh out, even though I could, you know, I could write a bloody novel on each individual person on that voyage. But let's just quickly trace forward a bit and just make sure, you know, we just cover off a bit on all the amazing things they did, you know, and just, yeah, you're right. It's just kind of, yeah, I love that too. It's like, I want to know more about that person. Mm. Well, yeah, let's find out. I mean, that's the great tragedy of the whole thing, and the space of it is that, you know, I would love to write about what happened to Philip and what happens to the colony and that, you know, but then I just had to keep it to this moment in time. You know, I love moments in time, like, you know, just bracketed moments in time, and I always found that's really interesting, and that's a very, very exciting thing as a storyteller to drill into one moment. And even though it's small, it's 8 months, you can expand it and sort of magnify it a bit. You know, it's like, I don't know, it's the small and the detailed speaking of the great and the very large. You know, that small 8 month story speaks of the debate that we'll have every January 26th, you know, for the next 20 years. Yeah. You know, that's it. That, you know, the bigger background to it is that great debate we're still having about where all this fits. But here's just a little 8 month insight into what we're actually talking about when we talk about that journey. So, but that's great. I love that you like the fast-forwarding
bits. I did, yeah. And I love that parallel to Run, Lola, Run. That's such a great parallel to the story.
Yeah.
Now, you didn't disappoint me because, like I said, you know, I have trouble engaging with raw history. I really need my historical fiction to kind of get me engaged. I know that's a personality flaw, but, you know, it is. No, not at all.
No, I'm the same. I really am. I need story. I need story. I really am. I don't like the dry.
I can Google facts. I don't need facts.
But some of
the imagery you use, like from the very first page, I'm going to read a snippet of your own writing, but I just thought it was so beautiful and just you opened this story. It was, sometimes history is only a question of size and space. The size of a pock sore on a young father's forearm, the space between two kneecaps when the working girls of Drury Lane open their legs. Like, so beautiful.
Oh, thanks, Danny. Oh, that's really cool. Yeah, you know, that's what got me excited about it, about writing it. Like, it's that sense, and I hope it's a thing. You know, it's sort of, I think it's a thing, like literary nonfiction almost. It's sort of and I always ask myself when I was writing it, like, how far I go with that? Like, but okay, well, if you keep to, okay, so there's a moment in that journey where, you know, Arthur Phillip gets to Botany Bay and he says, look, this actually, despite what Captain Cook said in his diary, and despite what even the brilliant, brilliant mind of Joseph Banks says that this is going to work, Arthur Phillip's a bright man and himself, and he knows very early that it's not actually going to work at Botany Bay. He's going to have to find somewhere else. And he sends this small boat. He leads this small boat up, and, you know, they discover the greatest bloody harbour in the world, Sydney Harbour, you know. And so, okay, how can I write about that? What do we know? Okay, we know the trees that were there. We know what the water looks like. We know the birds that were there. We know what the soil looked like. We know what it would have sounded like, you know. So they're facts, you know, that's you can go on that, you know, like, you know what I mean? And we know from the diaries about what happens. So, you know, a fish is caught, you know, or what happens? Who did they see? Where were they? We know that. And you can then tell that in just a literary way or an exciting way or a hopefully enchanting way that will keep people and go, oh, I didn't really think about it that way. And that's what I really wanted to incorporate all through it. Like, for my own needs too, I wanted to see it like that. And I wanted to go, yeah, what would have that sounded like? That would have been extraordinary to be the first white men going up Sydney Harbour. You know, that would have been incredible, you know, and, you know, just to sort of see that amazing harbour with fresh eyes and just sort of go, wow, because I see it now and I see, you know, I love Circular Quay. I just think it's the most extraordinary place. But, you know, I've seen it a fair few times now, but just to go up and see all of that before all of that stuff was there. I mean, I can't imagine what it's, you know, bloody hell. Imagine if you threw the Opera House right on it. That's the only thing that it needs. But, you know, but it's sort of like, yeah, it's such a beautiful place and they saw it for the first time. But I did dance with that all the time. It's like, what are people going to allow me to do? And I knew that people, you know, and, you know, particularly history buffs, they're like, oh, mate, you're probably going a bit too far here. And so you have to really, I would ratchet it back a bit and just go, look, you know, I can't get away with that, but I can get away with this because we have the facts here. And there's only just a couple of moments I've allowed myself just an indulgent little moment to just throw in a little brief little moment, you know, that just goes, because we know that that's what would have happened. And just like, let's just take people there just for that little brief moment. And we hopefully the reader knows that that isn't coming from some diarised account, but it's just to get you, the reader, into that moment and to just go, look, that is what is happening here. This is the grandeur of it. You know, you just need a couple of words where someone can say something and just go, this is it, we're here. You know, it's just like you need someone to say that, but no one diarises that, you know. Well, you know, so it's sort of like you've got to hopefully put the reader there a little bit, just a touch.
Well, I appreciated it, so thank you. I was right.
That's
there.
Great. Oh, thank you. Thanks for allowing me the indulgence, you know what I mean?
indulge away.
Just like, yeah, well, just like you're indulging me now as I ramble on about it. So thank you very much. I have to preface it. But it also shows you the wild places they were dropping into, you know. Yes. Like that's there, that's sort of him talking about kind of what it's like at the bottom of South Africa at that time. And they turn up there really desperately in need of food, right? Then they're going to need the rations that is going to help this colony sort of survive for about a year or so, much longer, or, you know, and really establish a colony there. Pretty strange old place, and shows you how raw the time was, and how even just how chancy that trip was. They were going into that place, and, you know, they get charged through the nose for everything they buy there. Because, of course, he's in a tight spot. It's like they can charge whatever the hell they bloody want because they know the Dutch who are down in South Africa, they know that this guy needs this stuff more than them, and he's desperate. He's not going to get his food anywhere else. And so he loses a lot of money on that trip. And, yeah, it's an incredible sort of insight, you know, and I think they wanted to get it the hell out of, you know, away from there, even as dangerous as the subsequent journey that were the rest of the journey they were on, in which they'll almost lose their lives in some of those storms that are really in the Southern Ocean. They're still happy to get away from that area down there, that's for sure. And I know, amazing time.
How vulnerable women must have been in that time. As a woman reading it, it was also quite terrifying going to this place where this is where, you know, this is how you're treated, and this is how you're treated in public. How are you treated not in public, like not when you're not in the public sphere? Like, it's quite terrifying. Oh, right?
Danny, I mean, you know, if I have time someday, I will, and I would love to analyze that night that I sort of write about. I don't have time to write about it as much, but it's sort of, you know, and Robert Hughes has written about it before, well before me, and written about it better. He, you know, described that incredible night when they do arrive on, you know, in Botany Bay, and they're starting that. Well, then they arrive, and then they're starting. Really, the colony is about to start, and there's this sort of moment of kind of strange release where everyone's kind of basically been described in over history as an orgy happens, and it's kind of but you have to really analyze that, and you think, okay, it's an orgy, but you imagine what went on as far as assaults and the birth of Australia, like, I mean, bloody hell, there's a dark history there to be told about how women were treated in that colony. I can't imagine how they fared, you know, and I just think there's probably a lot of dark tales to be told about that. But, you know, sadly, we don't have a lot of female histories. We don't have, you know, where was the 12th diary from Elizabeth Barber, you know? I mean, how amazing would that be to get Elizabeth Barber's account of that and all the bloody shit that went on to women? And, you're so right. It would have been horrendous. And, you know, and I talk about it in a kind of whimsical, kind of romantic way, in the sense of Arthur Phillip's great solution to the problems that are going to happen on that colony. He comes up with a pretty neat and incredible kind of incredibly wise solution, and that's family. So he says, basically, I want you to have a stake in this place. And for you to have a stake in this place, you're going to have a wife. You know, I mean, that's sort of and a child, you know, something to care about. You prisoners have never had anything to care about in recent times. But on this land, I want you to get something to care about. And that way you'll work for it, right? That's the best way to get people to work hard, is to remind them that they're bringing home something, they're building something, they're building towards something. But the flip side of that is, I wonder how many women just got into those relationships out of fear, because they knew they were incredibly vulnerable on this wild frontier. You know, it's sort of like, that is the untold story of the birth of Australia, the female side. Like always, I'm sorry, you know, like, it's like, where's
it's not
the
your fault, female Trent. Side?
No, well, you know, it's like, but you know, it's, you are, you're searching constantly. That's why I threw the Elizabeths in. Yeah. I wanted to show, and the Mary Bryants, they're the heroes of that story. The female figures are the greatest characters in that book. And, you know, I like that. And it's fantastic. But, you know, boy, where were the actual physical accounts? You know, it's just such an indictment on the times. It's didn't any of those blokes hand them a bunch of paper and pen, you know? Just,
that's right.
I still like, it's important to get your story as well. Yeah.
Now, I have a story for you. It's a bit more positive, about Boy Swallows Universe, in fact. So bear with me for a minute. So,
no, please.
Elliot Perlman has been one of my favourite authors for a decade, right?
Yeah, legend.
I reckon. Seven Types of Ambiguity. Oh, I just love it so much. Anyway, so I recently had him on the podcast, which I've been trying for a year, goal achieved.
And well
done. And then I met him. He came to my school. He mentored kids, et cetera, et cetera. I wanted to give him a gift, right, to say thanks, because he really cared about my kids, et cetera. And so I gave him your book, and I tell you why. So I gave him your book and I wrote in the front of it, because Seven Types of Ambiguity made me feel all those things that Boy Swallows Universe did.
Oh, wow.
So
wow.
I just wanted to share that with you.
Oh, Danny, that is the most amazing compliment. Thank you so much. That it means, you know what I mean, that you'd rate it, you know, even on a par with that guy's, you know, that with that book, you know, and it's like that. That is just like that, you know, that even belongs on the shelf with that. You know what I mean? That is just blows my mind. And the fact that you would even say that to him, that's just so beautiful. Thank you. That is like amazing. And that's so cool. Isn't that the power of books? Hey?
Yeah, you know yeah. I mean? It really like connects us. And I loved that, you know, giving my favorite author a book that was my favorite read this year. You know, I thought it was kind of special.
Oh, Danny, thank you. And yeah, isn't that amazing? I love that because it's an intimate sort yeah, of soulful kind of thing.
That's right.
It's sort of like, it's like you're saying to him, like, you know, this reminded me of that great thing that you gave me. Mm. All those years
I need
back,
to give
you
know? Something back like, to you. Yeah. Oh, so thanks, wow. Trent. Thanks for the gift.
Well, thank you to Elliot. Thank you to Elliot for doing that to a lot of Australians, hundreds of them.
I always put books into three categories: books I enjoy, books I love, yeah, and books that change me once I've read them. And, you know, Boy Swallows Universe and Seven Types of Ambiguity, they fall into the latter easily.
Oh, mate, Danny, thank you. That's really, that is so brilliant. You're just so cool. Like, I love that that you connected, you know, you connected with that early. And it's just like, because it is that type, look, I wrote it as that type of book, as I've sort of said. It's not a, you know, it doesn't read with the, you know, it does, like, it just needs a raw kind of emotional thing. Like, yeah, I just hope people, I love that when people say they got some emotional connection to it, because that's how it was written. It wasn't written with a kind of sense of Hemingway or something sort of, you know, I've said that about By Sea and Stars, but I'm, you know, I try my best to write it in a literary kind of, lyrical kind of way, but it's mostly just me trying to just cough up the soul, man, and just kind of just like, just go, here it is. Like, here's the whole box and dice. Like, it's like, and when I say box, I really mean the box that I opened up inside me, which has got all those memories and all that emotive connecting stuff. You know, it's like that I've kept my, you know, them, missing my mom or something is a box that's inside me, and missing the guy like Lyle in that book who raised me and wanting to see him, that's a box inside me. And I just opened up all those boxes and just went, here it is, and just jammed them but into that 470-page book. So, you know, it really means the world to me when you say that it connected and that it, you know, it's the latter, as you said, it's that latter category for you. That's just wild to me, Danny. That's just beautiful.
And I think when you have any spare time, you now need to read Seven Types of Ambiguity, and then we have to like get together and you can talk about each other's books.
We can, well, and I'll phone up Elliot Perlman and beg him for a little sort of, you know, sit down and we'll, that sounds great. That sounds wonderful.
Let's do that. I know that you're in Brisbane and I'm in Sydney and he's in Melbourne, but we can do this.
We're covering the East Coast. That's fantastic.
We can do this, I reckon.
That's great. No, but like, how cool though. What a guy though. He comes to your school, like seriously, and sits down and goes, helps your students. Like, I mean, Danny, like seriously, I know you do amazing stuff with kids and English and all that stuff, because it changes your bloody world. You know, it's like, man, it's like, I can't even tell you how many times a teacher sat me down and just went, hey, this is the one thing you can do, kid, you know, tell a story. Like, that's so powerful. You imagine Elliot Perlman coming to your class and telling you that. Like, that's,
I know,
like,
right? I have envy, like, of my own kids that I teach. I'm like, man, why didn't a teacher get Elliot Perlman for me?
Yeah. Totally. Totally. That's right.
I'm just living vicariously through them, so it's fine.
Hey, kids, Patrick White's here to tell you about, you know, I'm trying to think of someone back in the day who might have, yeah.
Now, you mentioned last time you had all these ideas for a new novel. Look, I know you've had two out this year. You might just want a bit of a rest, but is there something in the pipeline?
Oh, Danny, yes, yes. I'm so sort of neck deep in this world of this next book I'm writing, like the next novel, like a literary kind of fiction book, and I'm really excited about it. And do you want me to tell you like a line about what it is? Like,
yes. Is that a rhetorical question? Okay, come on.
Well, here's what it's about. It's about gifts that fall from the sky, and it's about curses that we dig from the earth, and it's about the secrets we hide inside ourselves. That's what it's about.
Wow. And you're going to make me wait like a year to read this glorious literary fiction.
Yeah. I'm sorry. That's all I could really
say
so
right.
far.
I understand. But amazing.
But I tell you one thing. It's from a really, really cool, raw, emotive place as well. And it's kind of like, I don't know. I'm really excited, and it's fully formed, and I'm really like, to be honest, I'm more excited about writing it than I was about Boyce Waller's Universe, because Boyce Waller's Universe was so kind of personal and kind of, yeah, it was
emotionally
like
exhausting.
Yeah, it was a real, like, whereas this is just pure story, and it's I mean, it comes from a real and raw personal place, if that makes sense, because I feel like I have to write from that, but like, it's still just so much like just some, like, it's just so adventurous and kind of story and kind of pure, and this character that is kind of at the center of it, I'm really kind of excited about, and I love already. You know what I mean?
I'm pretty excited too.
That gets me excited. So yeah,
I'm excited too, and I only know like one line about it.
That's good.
I just listened to your episode with JP on his podcast on writing, and I loved the part where you said before you wrote, you sat down and thought, what would life be like without your daughters, so you could just sort of bare your soul. Do you have some kind of morbid process for this book as well?
Oh, that's a great question, Danny. Yeah, like, yeah, that idea that, yeah, like, that like, get the electricity pulsing through you, right? And so you can actually physically do that. You know, you go to a raw place, and well, I'll tell you what I've been doing. You know what I mean? If you want to know, because I really dig talking to you, and forgive my rambling, but I mean, I'll tell you what I do and I will do with that, because this is what I'm saying about this raw place. It's longing to see my old man who died. Oh, you know, it's like, it's that's if there has to be a place, or if there is a place, it's that. And this story isn't about that by any stretch, but it kind of is, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
and it's about burial, and it's about death, but it's also about so much else, but so many other things. But it's like, but you know, it's rooted in a very real place, and that's why it sort of excites me. It's me dealing with those emotions that are very raw, and I've been thinking about that guy lately, because I kind of you know, it's like coming, it's nearing Christmas, and this strange year I've had, and that book, and my old man is the guy in Boyce Waller's Universe who, you know, woke up and he smoked his rollies and all he did was read books, and he'd have a book mountain that us boys, my three older brothers and I, would draw on. And I keep thinking, like, oh my God, that guy never got to see my book on a shelf, you know, and I just think, man, that is so sad. But it's sort of like, but I'm so inspired by that, in the sense that, you know, like, it's just, that's, you know, I want to do more for him, you know, I want to write more for him, I want to write more titles for him, you know, and just sort of, I tend to write the books that I know he'd read the hell out of, and sort of, you know, so that's really cool. And yeah, so, you know, I think I'll be thinking a lot about him, you know, through this next one. And it's sort of, even though he's not, he's nowhere near the sort of narrative at all, but it's sort of, you know, but yeah, and that really got me, it really powered me up when I think about sitting down to write Boyce Waller's Universe, thinking about these, you know, the greatest gifts in my entire life, the entire universe, is these two girls I've got, 11 and 9, and including my wife, you know, and her as well, you know, and these three girls, these three amazing humans, and think about, you know, the chances life could take you, and the places you could go, and how, you know, precarious your own story is, you know, how it's totally on a knife edge, and how that story could fall over at any time.
Yeah.
It'll go down a different path and go to a different chapter entirely. And so that would be extremely enervating, and you'd kind of just go bang, and you'd just pour that feeling, that chill down your spine. Like, it literally feels like that. And you just go, all right, now I'm going to write. You know, it's like that. That is seriously just a kind of, you know, it's that thing, you know, you write from the heart, you know, you don't write from the head, you write from your heart. So you need to open it up, you know, and if you have to charge it up, you have to sort of, you whack it with the vault of electricity, you know, you've got to sometimes go there through a memory. And, you know, that's been really handy to remember that. And I mean, that's my journalism. I do that because I get invested in these journalistic pieces. That's all from the people. So I've bloody started crying about people I'm writing a piece of journalism about. So I'm not thinking about my own memories there. I'm connecting to their story. And I go, okay, I'm just going to quickly charge that magazine piece up with that same feeling. And, yeah, you know, I think that's important to do. And I sort of say to people, just like, you know, write with the heart and kind of edit with the head. You know, don't worry about all that stuff later on. Edit, your head will take care of that. But that initial writing, you should be writing right from the heart and nowhere else, you know.
And I've just heard so many other authors talk about their writing process, but yours, just, it was just so beautiful to think that that's why there's so much honesty on your page. That's why it's so raw, and that's why it resonates so much with you, because it is. It's your heart and your soul on the page or on the laptop or whatever it is. And I think it's such an important process that you kind of might not think about. You might be thinking about technical things, you know, but what's the point of all the technical stuff if you don't have that heart and soul?
Oh, Danny, you're so right. I'm gonna transcribe what you just said and put well, you said that up it. In my front office. I'm sitting at it now, and I'm like, there's a little window. I'm going to stick it on there. Okay, that's it. What's the point?
It did come from you. I just kind of, kind of just reworded it, but it came from you. But yeah, thanks. I honestly cannot thank you enough for spending more time with me on this podcast to chat about This Time by Sea and Stars. It's such a treat having you on the podcast and having two books out. So thank you.
Danny, you're amazing. You're amazing. You talk beautifully about books, and your passion is just everywhere. So thank you so much for giving me the time of day. And I'm sorry to chew your ear off. And it's just always just the best. I really love chatting to you. So thank you so much.
Well, likewise. And if you come on again, I'll have to get you like co-host credit or something.
Done. That's right. Three appearances is officially a co-host. I think so. Three moves into co-host territory. Yeah, yeah.
I'm gonna watch that'd be back. Cool.
Together we can phone up Geraldine Brooks or some one of my heroes and just go, hey, I'm now a co-host of this. Can we get on?
Anytime, Trent, just say the word.
You're awesome.
Well,
you're
thank
great.
You
hey,
so much.
You have a Merry Christmas, hey, and thank you for everything you've done. And for Aussie writers this year, it's amazing, this podcast.